Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it feel like if you lost the ability to remember things for longer than 30 seconds for the rest of your life? This is what happened to a 27-year-old Connecticut man named Henry Molaison, who in 1953 underwent a partial lobotomy. His doctor hoped would relieve Molaison's debilitating epilepsy. The seizures did get better, but the surgery had unexpectedly robbed Molaison of his long-term memory, so that he could not recall specific episodes of his life before the surgery, nor form any new long-term memories. My guest today first met Molaison when she was a graduate student and worked with him for more than 40 years until his death in 2008. During that time, the genial and highly intelligent Molaison helped scientists make unprecedented strides in their understanding of how the human brain works. Suzanne Corkin is Professor Emerita of Neuroscience at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Her new book is called Permanent Present Tense, The Unforgettable Life of the Amnesic Patient HM. Suzanne, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Nice to talk with you, Chris.
So what were the dominant assumptions about how the brain stored and retrieved memories in the first half of the 20th century before Henry Molaison sort of entered medical science?
Before Henry, we didn't understand that the hippocampal region, the region that was excised from his brain, we didn't understand that this region is essential for the establishment of long-term memories. People knew that the brain was, of course, engaged for memory processing, but nobody knew sort of where it lived. They didn't understand that memory is compartmentalized, and they didn't understand that there were different kinds of memory with different addresses in the brain.
So Henry Molaison had a pretty unremarkable early childhood. He had parents who loved him a lot. How and when did his health problems begin?
Henry began having petit mal seizures when he was 10 years old. And then on his 15th birthday, when he was riding in the car with his parents, he had his first generalized convulsion, his first major seizure. Over the years, his attacks increased in frequency to the point where his daily activities were severely restricted. He took high doses of several anticonvulsant medications, but they just didn't do the job. So as a last resort, the chief of neurosurgery at the Hartford Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut, William Beecher Scoville, suggested to Henry and his family that he could perform a brain operation that might control the seizures.
And Scoville, you know, we hear about brain operations of this type, which is essentially, I guess, a targeted lobotomy. And that sounds very barbarous to us today. But Scoville had done a lot of research, and he was influenced by really important thinkers of the day to believe this experimental procedure might indeed be helpful.
Well, Scoville was a psychosurgeon. He did psychiatric surgery to destroy normal brain tissue to control psychiatric disease. His first area of attack in the brain was the frontal lobes, and he had done a number of lobotomies, the notorious prefrontal lobotomies. Mm-hmm. And he decided, based on his review of his cases, that just wasn't doing the trick, and he wanted to do more for patients with psychiatric disease. So he moved a little farther back in the brain to the temporal lobes. The frontal lobes are just behind your forehead. The temporal lobes are just behind that. And he had done varying sort of flavors of this operation in schizophrenic women who were housed in state hospitals in the Hartford, Connecticut area. And the results of these operations had been mixed. Patients were worse, some were better, and some stayed the same. But there were two patients in particular who stood out. They were operated on for psychosis, but they also had epilepsy. And Scoville, and I guess the physicians who were taking care of these particular patients, noticed that the seizures were palliated somewhat after the operation, that their seizures weren't as frequent as they had been before. So this was sort of a mini rationale for the operation. Another rationale came from Wilder Penfield at the Montreal Neurological Institute. He is the person who championed surgery for the relief of epilepsy. Mm-hmm. And he did initially temporal lobectomies in patients whose seizures could be localized using EEG recordings to either the left temporal lobe or the right temporal lobe. His operations were only on one side of the brain, and they were in the outer part of the temporal lobe. The operation that Henry had was on both sides of the brain, and it was the inner part of the temporal lobes that were excised in him.
How much did Henry and his parents, how much were they told about the potential risks of the procedure? And frankly, how much did Scoville know about the potential risks, given that knowledge of the brain was so rudimentary at the time?
Well, we have no knowledge, no information at all of what the consent procedure was like between Scoville and the family. Mm-hmm. Now, I know from what Henry told us that he understood, even after his operation, that the operation had been tried on only a few people before him. And he also had the impression that something had gone wrong during the operation.
What's interesting is that the surgery did seem to relieve the worst of Henry's epileptic seizures. Is that right?
That's true. He continued to have the petit mal seizures. The frequency of his grand mal seizures was definitely reduced. Some years he had none at all, and other years he might, just have a couple, up until the end of his life when he, again, returned to having a lot of seizures. But he did take anticonvulsant medication for the rest of his life, and we were very careful to monitor the drug levels for these different medications to make sure that he was always in the therapeutic range and he didn't have an overdose or an underdose.
So very soon after, when he was still recovering, it became apparent that something had gone terribly wrong. Can you talk about how family members recognized that Henry was not okay?
Well, I think they, it took him a day or two to sort of recover from the insult of the operation.
Sure.
But while he was still in the hospital, they observed that he didn't recognize staff members that had come regularly into his room, and he didn't know how to find the bathroom, and, for all practical purposes, he wasn't laying down any new memories at all.
That had to have been just a terrifying experience. What do you know about how aware Henry was initially that this was happening to him?
Well, I didn't study him. The operation was in 1953,
yeah.
And I met him in 1962. Mm-hmm. So I honestly don't know the answer to that question, but I can tell you that, during all of the years that I interacted with him, he was definitely aware that he had a problem with his memory. Mm-hmm. And he, you'd ask him a question, and if he didn't know, he'd say, "You see, I don't remember things." Mm-hmm. And he had excellent insight into that, and also into the fact that he had epilepsy. He knew he had epilepsy before the operation. He knew that he still had epilepsy after the operation.
So you met him in the early 60s. He was living with his mother at the time, but she had taken him to the facility that you were studying at to do some testing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about what testing is even like with someone who cannot remember instructions for very long.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a good question. Henry was actually very good at instructions because his capacity for attention, his attentive processes were intact. But, for testing, we give the instructions, and say, for example, it's a vocabulary word. And so you precede the test with a little sentence like, "I want to see how many words you know. I'm going to read you a word, and I want you to tell me what it means." And so then, we would start with a word like house, mm-hmm. or something like that. But we would say, "What does house mean?" So he had the instruction, right, who was holding it online in his brain, mm-hmm. and then he could tune in to his mental dictionary and give you a definition of house or any other word. Now, for some tests, we wrote the instructions down on little index cards and put these cards in front of him so that he always had He always knew what he was supposed to do. We wanted to be very careful that we weren't testing his memory for the instructions rather than the material that was germane to the actual test. Hmm. So we were very cognizant about this, but he really was very good at instructions. For example, when he did the Wisconsin card sorting test, he was asked to sort 128 cards that had different shapes in different colors in different numbers on each card. And this was a test where he had to sort of guess what the right answer was, and we would just say yes or no, indicating whether he was right or wrong. And he was able to maintain these instructions and the set of whether he was sorting to color or to shape or to number. He could maintain this learning set, this test set, during the test, and he actually did very, very well on the test.
So this is really interesting. As we've established, Henry couldn't, as you say, lay down new memories after he had this surgery, and he could remember sort of basic themes from the time before the surgery, but events, specific events, were harder for him.
Yes. So he had very rich mental representations covering the period from his birth, which was 1926, up to August of 1953 when he had the operation. He knew he was born in Manchester, Connecticut, and he had extensive family memories. He knew that his father's family came from Thibodaux, Louisiana, and that his mother's family came from Ireland. He talked fluently about the towns in the Hartford area where he lived before his operation, and also mentioned the names of specific neighbors. He also knew the schools he attended. He knew some of his classmates' names. And then in conversation, he'd mention what he did for fun, like roller skating, ice skating, banjo lessons, target practice. So overall, in spite of his epilepsy, he had the gist of the well-rounded life he experienced before his operation. The quality of these memories, however, was severely compromised in the following way. Excuse me. He lacked what we call episodic autobiographical memories. And this means that he couldn't recall anything that happened at a specific time and place, a unique event. Hmm. What he did retain was only the essence of his preoperative experiences. So here's an example. He and his family loved to go for drives on a scenic drive in Massachusetts called the Mohawk Trail. And Henry could describe the landscape and tell you what statues were along the way and where there were hills. But what he could not do was recount a specific event that happened on one particular day. So he couldn't say, for example, I remember one day we were driving on the Mohawk Trail. I was riding in the car with Dad and Mother, and it started snowing, and the snow really came down, and wouldn't you know it, we got stuck in the snow. And luckily, a very nice man came along and attached a rope to our car and pulled us out. So he never had any specific episodes like that. And this deficit tells us that we need both of our hippocampi, the structures that were removed in his brain. Mm-hmm. We need both of these structures to retrieve autobiographical episodes.
Suzanne Corkin is with us. She's professor emerita of neuroscience at MIT and author of the new book, Permanent Present Tense, The Unforgettable Life of the Amnesic Patient, HM. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Suzanne Corkin, who is Professor Emerita of Neuroscience at MIT and author of the new book, Permanent Present Tense, The Unforgettable Life of the Amnesic Patient, HM. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Suzanne, this is really fascinating. Henry was an intelligent young man. He had finished high school. So although he couldn't remember specific incidents like, you know, the snowstorm on the trail from his own life, he could remember Abraham Lincoln was president during the Civil War. This is what the Civil War was about. Judy Garland was a movie star. These are the songs she sang. What does that suggest about the different ways that human brains create and store memories?
Well, what it tells us with respect to the information that he learned before his operation is that although his hippocampus, I'm sure, was engaged on both sides of his brain to initially encode and store this memory, during the process of consolidation, these memories move out of the medial temporal zone and into the cortex. So the cortex is a vast area, and memories are stored all over the place there. When you retrieve a memory, if you're, for example, thinking about what you did on your last birthday, you're pulling information not from one little node in your brain that's labeled last birthday. You're pulling information from many areas of your brain related to that stores information from different sensory modalities like vision and hearing and touch and smell. And when you retrieve this memory, you're carrying on a creative process. So every time you retrieve a memory of that birthday, it's going to be a little bit different because each time you do it, you're putting together the stored traces in a slightly different way. And by retrieving them and sort of massaging them, when they go back into being stored, they're reshaped slightly.
So we're not aware that they may be shifting over time. They feel like the same memory to us each time we call them up.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But in fact, the hippocampus is necessary for the retrieval of those memories after the onset of amnesia. The hippocampus is also necessary for retrieval of the episodes that occurred before the operation.
What would be I'm sorry, continue, please.
Well, when I say hippocampus, this is just a shorthand for these medial temporal lobe structures because the cortex around the hippocampus and the inner part of the temporal lobe, this is also a memory area.
So in terms of short-term learning in those 30-second bursts that Henry was able to store information, he could remember things just as well as you or I could, right, in that 30-second chunk of time?
Yes, he could. So, you know, if I rattled off a series of digits to him, like 3, 6, 9, 8, 5, he could say 3, 6, 9, 8, 5. So he could hold things online. And I actually have a wonderful example of how he sort of tricked us by engaging his immediate memory. So in 1986, a postdoctoral fellow in my lab, Jenny Ogden, told Henry that she would leave him alone for a little while. And she said, when I return, I'm going to ask you to guess how long I've been gone. So she left the room at 2:05, and she returned at 2:17. And she said, hi, Henry, how long have I been gone? And he immediately said, 12 minutes, got you there. Now, how did he do it? Well, she was really just bowled over by this, shocked out of her mind. And then she noticed that there was a clock on the wall. And so what Henry had done was to look at the clock when she left and saw that it was 2:05. And either he might have said 2:05, 2:05, or 5 after 2 over and over again. He rehearsed this key information over and over again. So he kept it alive in his immediate memory. And then when she returned at 2:17, he looked at the clock, subtracted 5 from 7, and said 5 from 17, and came up with 12 right away. He had a wonderful sense of humor, so he loved doing things like this.
You know, I would imagine that, you know, it must have been surprising to find things like that and to see, I mean, after a while, you got to know him so well that the sense of humor didn't take you by surprise. But were people surprised that his quality of life seemed pretty good? Like, he doesn't seem to have been anxious or miserable most of the time.
I think that's a fair statement, that he was not anxious or miserable most of the time. He did have, you know, moments of wondering whether he had done something wrong. But for the most part, you know, he led a quiet life. At first, at home with his mother and father, he watched a lot of television, he read magazines, and of course he could read the same magazine over and over without knowing he had already read it. And then after that, he went to live with a distant relative for 5 years, and she had a very she had a house where there were a couple of other residents, and it was a very structured environment for him. He had, you know, a certain schedule that he went through, and he watched television there. He socialized with the other people who lived there. He was a gun collector. He and his father had a gun collection, so Henry loved to read his gun magazines.
Was he?
And the sort of trademark of all of this was that he smiled a lot. He was a real smiler, and I think that, you know, says that he accepted his fate and he just dealt with it.
Was he able to follow the plots of the television shows that he watched, or really from the, you know, I can read a magazine article that might take me half an hour. Was he able to sort of have a sense at least of what had come before enough to understand the next sentence or the next minute of TV?
Maybe the next minute, but not the next 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that he really couldn't follow the plot of a television program. But interestingly, even so, for programs that he watched a lot and celebrities that he saw over and over again, he did retain some declarative memory. So this is an exception to his profound memory impairment. For example, he knew that Archie Bunker called his son-in-law Meathead. And he knew that this wasn't a very nice name.
Mm-hmm.
So he did extract bits of factual information from television and also from magazines.
So you knew him for 45, 46 years, is that right?
Yes, 46 years.
Talk about the point at which you felt as though he was at least familiar with you.
Yes, so in the beginning, in 1962, I was a perfect stranger, just like everybody else was in Milner's lab. But then, starting around in the 1980s, he'd say that he knew me from high school.
Hmm.
Now, over the years, he built up a sense of familiarity for my face and my name. From 1966 on, he visited us at the MIT Clinical Research Center on 50 occasions, and these were not brief visits. These were for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So he saw my face an awful lot, and he also heard Suzanne Corkin over and over and over again. So as a result of this constant exposure, this constant repetition, he believed that he knew me, and this feeling likely became stronger as time went on.
And I suppose that suggests that there's some other mechanism in the brain that sometimes memories can be laid down in a different fashion if there's enough familiarity?
Yes, exactly. We came to understand this over the years, that there are, due to theoretical advances in cognitive science, we now recognize two kinds of recognition memory. One is called recollection. And that's the kind of memory you engage when I ask you, what did you do for dinner last night? And you tell me this whole scenario about your dining experience. That's recollection. Henry could not do that. And that kind of recognition memory is dependent on the hippocampus. There's another kind of recognition memory, and that's called familiarity. And this is where you just remember one specific item, like a face, for example. So, for example, if you're walking down the main street in your city and you suddenly see somebody coming towards you and you think, oh, I know who that is. But who is it? How do I know him? What's his name? Gee, I don't know his name. I don't know where I crossed paths with him. Was it, you know, does he live in my neighborhood? Does he work at the supermarket? Is he in my yoga class? You have no associations with this face at all. You can't associate that one item with any other item, and you can't put that item, that face, into any kind of context. And that's recognition based on familiarity. And that is the kind of memory system, memory mechanism, that Henry engaged when he could say, yes, I know you from high school. Now, we know from another patient who had a lesion in a different area, and from functional MRI studies, that a structure right near the hippocampus, the perirhinal cortex, supports this kind of familiarity-based recognition. In Henry's brain, on both sides, a little bit of perirhinal cortex was preserved. Mm. So our hypothesis is that he was engaging this other memory circuit and also his cortex, which was intact, to say, yes, he knew me from high school.
So you spoke earlier a little bit about his trick with pretending that he could tell how long someone had been out of the room. What was his perception of time like? And was he able to, did he engage in predicting what might happen in the future?
Actually, I'll just sort of two questions there. With respect to his sense of time, he did know that years were passing. Mm-hmm. So if we asked him how old he was, on a particular day, he would always guess that he was younger than he was, and maybe even 11 years younger than his actual age at that time. So time progressed for him, but more slowly than it does for everybody else. But with respect to looking into the future, he was completely at a loss. He couldn't construct an agenda. So before, or rather after his operation, he often stated, actually over and over, stated that he wanted to be a brain surgeon, but could not because he wore glasses. And he had several different scenarios to explain why the glasses were an impediment. But that said, he didn't have a plan B or a plan C or a plan D. Now, in high school, he had taken the practical course, and so he had skills, and he had held several different jobs before his operation. He had been a motor winder. He had worked on an assembly line of Royal Typewriter. But he couldn't generate any future plans. So when I asked him what he thought he would do tomorrow, he would say, whatever is beneficial. Full stop. He couldn't create a future and was never able to chase his dreams because he didn't have any. Now, what this tells us in terms of brain function is that you need to have these hippocampal memory structures intact in order to retrieve specific, say, for example, you're planning a vacation. Mm-hmm. You don't just do this in a vacuum. You think about other vacations you've had or haven't had. You know, I've never been to Boston, so let's go to Boston this year. So you have to have a memory that you've never been to Boston. And you could say, well, you know, I don't think I want to go camping because the last time I went camping, I got eaten up by mosquitoes. So you draw on all of your past experiences in planning your future. And he just couldn't do that. He didn't have that resource.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, you build the future out of your memories of the past.
Exactly, exactly.
What kind of memory did Henry have for places and spaces?
For places?
Places in space or for physical locations.
Well, for after his operation, none at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, he couldn't remember where his room was, and he had to be guided to his room in the Bickford Healthcare Facility. And once he got in the room, he didn't know which bed was his or which side of the shared closet his clothes were on. Mm-hmm. Now, for before his operation, he could describe quite accurately the streets right around the Hartford Hospital and the different institutions that were there. And he also could talk about the geography of East Hartford and Manchester, and he did that with us. I also grew up in the Hartford area, and one of my research assistants did too. So we would have lots of conversations with him about, oh, do you remember this street, or did you know this family? And his preoperative map was good, mm-hmm. but his postoperative map was blank.
But then there was a case where he had lived in a house after his surgery.
Yes. Now, this is an exception to everything that I just told you.
Okay.
He moved in to a house in East Hartford, 63 Crescent Drive in East Hartford, a few years after his operation. And at one point, while he was living there, 1966, he came up to MIT, and we asked him to draw the floor plan of his house. And lo and behold, he did it. Of course, we didn't know whether it was right or not, but we then showed it to the person who was driving him back and forth. And she said, yes, this is it. This is what the house looks like.
Wow.
So then, it gets better. After a few years, they moved out of the house into another house, or actually in with a distant relative. And even after he moved out of the house, he could still draw the floor plan of that house. When I was curious, I mean, I wanted to be very rigorous about saying whether he got it right or he didn't get it right. So I contacted the person who lived in the house after the Mollisons moved out, and I said, "Could you send me? Do you have a floor plan of the house?" It turns out he was in the real estate business, and he sent me back a floor plan by return email, which was unexpectedly wonderful. And Henry had just gotten it perfectly. The only difference between the floor plan that I got and Henry's was that future owners had knocked down the wall between the kitchen and dining room to make an eat-in kitchen. And in Henry's, there were two rooms, kitchen and dining room. But he definitely got it right. Not only that, he could tell you how to navigate around the house. So if I said to him, this was a small house all on one floor, if I said, Henry, if you're in the living room and you want to walk to your bedroom, which way would you turn? And he could tell me. If you're in your bedroom and you want to walk to the kitchen, which way would you turn? On which side of the hall would it be?
Wow.
And he could get that right, too. So this was really very shocking and impressive.
Got to jump in and take a quick break. My guest is Suzanne Corkin. We're talking about her new book, Permanent Present Tense. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Suzanne Corkin of MIT. She's Professor Emerita of Neuroscience there. Her new book is called Permanent Present Tense, The Unforgettable Life of the Amnesic Patient HM. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Suzanne, this story about Henry being able to accurately draw a floor plan of a house he had moved to after his accident is really astonishing. I have a poor sense of spatial skills anyway, but what did you do with this information when you realized that he had done it correctly, and how can you possibly explain this?
It's very difficult to explain, and I've actually consulted with many neuroscientists who study the hippocampus and have shown with lots of rigorous research that the hippocampus is responsible for forming your cognitive map of the world and for supporting navigational capacities. Hmm. So it's very hard to explain, and we're still working on that. I mean, it's just an outstanding puzzle, and I've had a few fascinating ideas from other scientists, and we're all still trying to make sense of this.
1-800.
I mean, first of all, the way you have to think of how he learned this. So he was pretty much confined to this small space.
Right.
This was his world. You know, he'd occasionally go to the market with his mother or go to church, or work in the yard. That was about it. So he had many, many repetitions of traversing this path from the living room to his bedroom, from the bedroom to the kitchen. So you might think of it as non-declarative learning, just learning with practice over time. The same way he could learn motor skills. And you can think of this maybe in the same circuits we're operating that support. He just had practice, you know, one practice trial after another, day after week, after month, after year, and it enabled him to come up with this map of his house, this mental map.
It's interesting, though, because it's not automatic in the way that, you know, if you live in a house where the light switches are sort of at waist length, you get used to flipping on a light there. It's not quite the mm-hmm. same as that, though, right?
No, it's much more complicated than that, because it's not just one spot and how it works. It's a whole organized map.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We had an email from Sam who's curious about whether Henry had any interest in a romantic life.
Postoperatively, no. Mm-hmm. He was examined on several occasions by psychiatrists who all determined that he did not have any psychiatric diagnosis. But the last one who examined him, George Murray, went into the domain of sex quite thoroughly and, you know, asked Henry lots of questions about, you know, information about sexual behavior. And Henry, you know, knew about intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
But he never had any sexual desires at all. He didn't masturbate. He didn't make passes at women. And the psychiatrist determined that he was asexual, without completely lacking a sex drive, lacking libido. Now, before his operation, I have photos from his preoperative years of Henry with a girl named Maud, and they're standing on a beach, and they have their arm around each other. And, you know, it looks like he would, I don't know if this was a serious girlfriend, but it looked like she was certainly a girlfriend. And I also have a picture of Maud posing in a pin-up pose. And on the back she wrote, "For Henry, love Maud." So definitely women were a part of his life. In addition, I have letters from two of his friends who were in the service right before the Korean War. And they talk a lot about girlfriends and specific girls and going dancing and saying things like, "Don't get married before we get back." And so, you know, there were these allusions to a social life with women.
Hmm. So does that suggest to you that memory may be involved in sexual desire?
I think that one of the structures that was removed in his brain was the amygdala.
Mm-hmm.
The amygdala is right in front of the hippocampus. It's sort of hand in glove. And they communicate a lot with each other back and forth. But we believe that it's the removal, that massive damage to the amygdala that accounts for this asexual behavior.
What were you able to learn about Henry's brain as all these technologies that we now take for granted began to come online in the latter part of the 20th century? Magnetic resonance imaging, for one thing.
Yes, that was wonderful. So Scovel estimated that he had removed 8 centimeters of Henry's brain on each side from the tip of the temporal lobe back. And once with the advent of MRI, we learned that this was quite an overestimate, because we could see in the MRI scans that the removal was only 5.4 centimeters on the left side and 5.1 on the right. In addition, as he got older, we were also, with MRI and advanced technology, able to document some pathology in his brain, not related to the operation, but just related to getting old. So he had small strokes, very small strokes in the white matter, under the gray matter of his brain, scattered throughout his brain. And he eventually became demented.
Mm-hmm.
And when he died in 2008, he was completely dependent on other people for his care, and he was mute. So now, you know, when he died, we did an autopsy, and we now have his brain. The brain has been sectioned into 2,401 slices, and these are now the subject of intense scrutiny under microscopes. So it gives us a much better look at the cells in the brain and the white matter tracts, the communication systems in the brain, and we will be able to make a much better determination of exactly what tissue was removed, what tissue was left behind, and what the abnormal features are in his brain.
Is there anything that you can know on a cellular level, but you're not entirely sure if those changes are due to the problems he had later in life or if they relate directly to the surgery?
Well, if there's a big hole in the brain, we know that that was due to the surgery.
Right.
And in addition, his cerebellum was very much shriveled. The cerebellum is a huge structure that's hanging off the back of your brain. Mm-hmm. And it's a structure that supports motor control, balance, movement, and subcognitive functions. So because he took the anticonvulsant medication Dilantin for many, many years at very high doses, his cerebellum has shriveled. It has atrophied. That's a known side effect of Dilantin. So this is something that, you know, was related to a drug and not the operation and not to old age. Mm-hmm. With respect to newer lesions, neuropathologists are able to document the age of the lesion to say whether it's old or new.
How were decisions made about what tests were worth sort of putting Henry through and which ones might have been, if not abusive, just really an interruption of his right to sort of live in privacy and do what he chose?
Well, with respect to the privacy issue, we never identified him by name. That's why everyone knew him as HM. And we never allowed people from the media to interview him in person. I did a recording in 1992. The CBC came to MIT and recorded an interview that I had there with Henry. So he, you know, his voice is on that, but not his face, and he wasn't identified by name. In addition, as you might guess, every media outlet in the world practically wanted to come to MIT and do videos of HM, and we never permitted that. Brenda Milner, the one who first reported the findings in HM, and I were really adamant about that and about protecting his privacy and his anonymity. Now, the other question you asked, how do we decide which test to do? This changed over the years because in research, not just with HM and memory, in all research, you have hypotheses and you do a certain set of experiments, and those experiments lead to new hypotheses, new questions, and new experiments. And that's the way science progresses in all fields, and that's exactly the way it happened with Henry. So initially, of course, we wanted to see what his intelligence was, and what we discovered was that it was above average, and this told us that you can be an intelligent person and still have a dreadful memory. Hmm. So that was an important early discovery. Another one was that his immediate memory was preserved. That was very useful for, you know, conversations and giving him instructions and just, you know, having a simple conversation with him. Then after that, one of the question that I investigated in my PhD thesis was whether his memory impairment extended into the sense of touch. So all the initial testing that had been done with him, the memory testing, used material presented visually, like pictures or words, or auditorily through vision or hearing. We could read him a story and see whether he could say it back. But the sense of his sense of touch hadn't been explored, and that was the purpose of my PhD thesis. And what I discovered was that he could not learn a new maze from start to finish using his sense of touch. He couldn't, with over 80 trials, did not decrease his errors. He kept going into blind alleys for 80 trials and did not learn the correct sequence of turns. Normal people learn this in fewer than 30 trials, so he was really very impaired.
A research subject is a research subject, and yet this is a person that you knew for more than half of your own life, well over half of your own life. Was there a grieving process when Henry finally died for you?
Yes, but it wasn't immediate. So when he died, we had started planning for what we would do when Henry died in 2002. Because I knew that it was absolutely vital to get his brain and to study it in detail and determine exactly where his lesion was, what had been preserved, and what else had gone on in his brain after the operation. So in 2002, I assembled a committee that's for the postmortem examination of HM's brain. And this consisted of neuropathologists from Mass General, neurologists, from Mass General, neuroradiologists, imaging people, and neuroscientists from my lab. And we met fairly regularly, more so as time went on. And we eventually formulated a specific plan about what we would do, plans, plural. Mm-hmm. And we even had a call list. So start with this name and call it. We had two call lists. And so when he died, my brain immediately jumped into, we've got to do this right because we only have one chance with the most famous brain in the world mode. And so I was immediately about the business of contacting other people, contacting his conservator, telling the people at the Martino Center at Mass General that, you know, we would want to image HM that night. And so that's what I focused on. And in fact, a hearse brought his body up to Mass General, and he was in the scanner just under 4 hours after his death. We scanned him for 8 hours overnight. And during that time, then I had time. I wasn't doing the scan myself. I was sort of in the outer room. Mm-hmm. And that's when I had time to really think about, you know, Henry died. Henry died. Wow. And, you know, that's when it sort of hit me for the first time. And so that's when I wrote his obituary. I had previously talked to his conservator and said, you know, when Henry dies, would you like me to help you with his obituary? And he said yes. Hmm. So I started doing that. And, of course, it just flooded me with memories, wonderful memories of him and, you know, of all the wonderful interactions that I and all of my colleagues had with him and how grateful we were to him for everything that he had done. And, you know, we continue to experience that gratitude and really admiration for him.
Suzanne Corkin is Professor Emerita of Neuroscience at MIT and author of Permanent Present Tense, The Unforgettable Life of the Amnesic Patient HM. Suzanne, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones from Christina Martinez, and Christine McConnell does the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.